Hello, and welcome to Tolerable Risk, the podcast for NGO, nonprofit, and charity professionals who manage risk. I'm your host, Sabrina Siegel. Today, we're going to talk to Mohammed Shaheen. Mohammed is a fraud examiner with 14 years of professional experience working with high-profile multinational organizations in the Middle East and Europe. During his professional career, he has worked for two of the big four firms. Mohammed has extensive experience in managing the fraud and risk functions in the humanitarian sector, and his focus areas are counter-fraud, risk management, investigation, internal audit, information systems audit, project management, and control assessment. He holds a master's degree in the management of business innovation and technology and is a CFE, CISA, and CISM certification holder. Welcome, Mohammed. Thanks for coming on Tolerable Risk.
Welcome, Sabrina, and thanks for having me today.
We're very happy to have you here to talk about investigations. So before we get started, can you tell us just a little bit about yourself, your background, and how did you find yourself in the third sector?
Okay, so you've covered a lot of my background. So I'm just going to tell you the funny story, and it's actually a funny story. I'm a person who finished his studies in the wrong time in history. I was planning to work a lot more on innovation and making businesses bigger in terms of my studies, but I finished during the economic bubble of 2008. So instead of making things bigger, the only thing that I was offered at the time was the exact opposite, was to deal with risk because everything was downsizing. And this is where it all started. So I started with a career focusing enterprise risk. And then from that, I kind of narrowed down into the areas of governance, including internal audit. And then from that, with time, I started focusing on counter fraud and things relating to investigation and things relating to that area. There was one funny story that happened to me that actually led me into moving into the third sector. Is I was corporate all the way, consulting, advisory up until around 10 years ago. And then at that point in time, I decided to do something different with my life. And I think that's when I actually climbed Mount Kilimanjaro. So just going through that climb and seeing how simple things in life might make a difference, and how even giving someone the minimal thing of like clean water or something to keep them warm would make them happy and grateful and would make a great change in their life. So as soon as I summited Kilimanjaro and I came back, and it was a climb that I did for charity by accident at that point in time, it was something switched in my head. I came back, I resigned from my high-paying advisory job, and I looked for something that can make a change. I went through a few freelancing projects for the humanitarian sector, and one of them just ended up saying, this report is really good, so we're offering you a job. This is kind of the short story of how I ended up in the third sector.
That's amazing. So Kilimanjaro led you to working in the humanitarian world. I can see that connection. That's such a great story. So let me ask you this then. The fact that you have this really varied background, you've been in the private sector, you've been in the third sector. Compared to the private sector, how are investigations viewed by the third sector? What would you say is embraced and what is rejected?
I think your question is spot on. The answer has shifted a lot during the last few years. So if you asked me this question 5 years ago, I would say, oh, we can't even call it an investigation. We have to call it a review because you're in the third sector. You're talking about an NGO or a humanitarian actor or at least a nonprofit. So you cannot call it an investigation because it raises 100 red flags. But in the last few years or in the last couple of years, this has shifted dramatically. So now more and more of the drivers and the stakeholders, including the main donors, the governments, are saying, if you want to be in the third sector, if you want to be supported, then you actually need to look into investigations. If something goes wrong, you actually need to be able to respond. Otherwise, we're not backing you up. And that has shifted the paradigm completely into organizations regarding of their size, trying to find the best appropriate measure or technique that they can follow to be able to respond to this new world or this new environment that they're being put on. So at the moment, a lot of the things that were historically rejected, as in people were refusing to do interviews for an investigation or being interviewed, people were refusing to initiate investigations because of the reputation of their organization. People were refusing to even address the findings of the organization, and a lot of people were given golden parachutes just to leave after the wrongdoing. These things are no longer applicable because an organization is no longer living in the shame culture where they can't say that they've been a victim of fraud, because all the big organizations and the big players have statistics of the number of cases that they have actually investigated and how they're dealing with it and their amount of losses. Now you even have financial crime insurance, which any organization can get. So we're no longer in the dark ages that we used to be a decade ago. We're actually in a place where organizations, regardless of their size, can say, we want to embrace this. However, it's a matter of cultural change. So some organizations are more advanced than others, and some organizations are in transition at the moment. So they're embracing the first steps of getting investigations on the way, or some of them might actually just paraphrase it, say it's a special audit or a forensic audit or whatever it is. So they have a way of putting it together. But I think generally the concept of investigation is being very well embraced in the third sector.
That's such a great way of thinking about it. I love how you were talking about the shame culture, Mohammed, and the fact that it comes down to organizational culture as to how well or how even accepted investigations are. And a lot of it is terminology. So what sort of concepts or themes do you think people get wrong? When they hear investigation, what are they thinking about that is misunderstood?
So when people hear investigation, one thing that always jumps to me whenever I'm doing an investigation or planning an investigation or leading someone that's doing an investigation is they immediately think police or a policing function, or someone is going to get in real legal trouble. They don't think of an investigation as something that's actually independent and may have two outcomes. They automatically think that if there's an investigation, someone has to be found guilty. And by being found guilty, this will eventually end up in authorities or disciplinary action. However, when you're talking about investigations from our perspective, or let's say from the third sector, professionals are usually not actually there to identify guilt. They're actually there to review an allegation, look into it, and substantiate this allegation based on evidence, or say they don't have enough evidence to substantiate these allegations. The guilt and whether actions need to be done is part of the investigation function itself. It's a management decision. And I think people need to actually understand that when you have an investigation or when you are being investigated, you're being given the chance to portray what was done and portray your point of view, instead of just having actors and managers or the senior management in the company, in the organization, just taking a blind decision on fire this person or call the police or do this or that.
So this leads me then to my next question, because you hit on a lot of really important topics in your answer there. How would you advise organizations on how to address the culture around investigations if maybe they don't have an investigation program or structure in place already? If they want to start a new one, they realize that they need to have something in place, whether it's to respond to donor inquiries or whether it's because they know it's the right thing to do and have. What would you suggest? How can a small to medium-sized organization establish this type of program for investigations? And then how can they really address that culture challenge?
Okay, so this is where small steps take you a long way. And the 10-mile marathon always starts with one step. So small steps are what you're looking for. It's for the leadership of this small to medium organization initially to start embedding this culture by using the right terminology when addressing their staff, when addressing their partners. So speaking with words that will echo in the mind of people, like zero tolerance toward these things, as well as trying to empower their staff to, if you see something wrong, or if you see something that is suspicious, you can report it to us, where you're not going to be penalized for reporting or misreporting. It's going to be reviewed in a fair manner. So starting with the tone at the top, starting with normalizing the reporting process, normalizing an idea of discussing these issues openly by starting with the top management, starting with yourself, is the first step for any organization, especially small to medium organizations, to look at these things. The second step would probably be a small procedure so that they can put a procedure, even if it's a one pager, saying if you receive an allegation, these are the steps that are going to be carried, as in it's going to be reviewed. Four people or three people would be involved in independently reviewing it and assessing its credibility. And based on that, they would advise on how the investigation to be done. For example, if it's a small or a medium organization, they might have trained a few staff of their own to do the investigation. So they have an investigation committee, or they might have a service level agreement with a provider of these services. There are a lot of firms that provide internal investigations for organizations. So they might have these relationships where they can actually, if the issue requires an in-depth or technical investigation, they might get outside help. So just having that, these procedures would actually say that regardless of who the wrongdoer is, or regardless of the type of the action, each allegation or each report would be dealt with in a consistent manner. So having those two steps, the first step is building the culture and starting to embed aspects of the culture in your action as management, as well as having a consistent fair procedure, regardless of how complex it is, would be the first steps for any organizations to actually be able to address these concerns and be able to move into a more mature culture when it comes to investigations.
And speaking of culture, can you talk a little bit about retaliation? A lot of people are concerned about either reporting, engaging in an investigation, so responding to the investigator, showing up for an interview, providing documents, because they're worried about retaliation. As an investigator and your background and experience working in both the private and the public sector, or the third sector, what do you advise on organizations when it comes to retaliation? And is that something that should really be front and center when you're designing your investigation program?
Oh, absolutely. So it goes into multiple layers when you're dealing with retaliation. The first layer is, I'm going to say, confidentiality again. So when you're designing your program, you should make sure that your investigators whoever actually within the circulation list of that investigation report understand that this is a confidential report. It's not something that's going to be end of the water cooler gossip type of thing that will eventually, if the allegations were not substantiated, will let the potential subject retaliate against whoever reported against them. So that's the initial step. The other thing is building a culture where you can have different options when you report. So you can report anonymously, be it from something as simple as a complaint box where you can type something and throw it in, no one would have to know who actually wrote the back complaint, to a more sophisticated online reporting platform. So having multiple channels so that people can, if they choose to report, report anonymously also helps with retaliation. And finally, it's the culture. So we go back to the tone at the top, the culture, and getting a lot of messages from all over, from all through the management, the mid-management, the top management, or your colleagues, that it's okay to report, getting that message frequently, having it in all the walls, all of these things, and asking people to deal with reporting in a more objective rather than a subjective matter. Something, a note to keep in mind, in more developed countries, you actually have laws to help you address retaliation. So whistleblowing laws, rules, regulations that are enforced on the organization. So you need to also understand the context, because that might be something that you actually have to put in place. It's not something that is optional.
That's great. The regulatory environment that you're working in is really important. But like you said, it comes back down to culture. All these things tend to come back down to culture. And everyone kind of looks at it and says, okay, culture this, culture that. But it's really, really important. It's such the key to so many things in the integrity, risk, and compliance sector that we need to think about. But we know, both of us know from experience, that those are really hard to do sometimes. I mean, all the time. Building an organizational culture is so tough. And ensuring that you can get the trust of your staff to engage with those reporting tools, and ensuring that you have neutrality, or at least as close as you can to it when you're reviewing those reports, is really tough. You have thoughts on that?
Yeah, of course. And that's why having people like you, Sabrina, is an advantage, because when you can actually talk to someone, when you can, you don't have to rely on yourself for everything. Like, I'm sure if people come to you and tell you, can we take an hour of your time to talk to our staff and explain that this is happening across all organizations, not just our organization, you'd be more than happy to do it pro bono. The same thing is with me. Sometimes you're asked to do these things just to normalize. So the idea is, don't try to carry the load on your own, and try to use all the resources that you have, not only internal. If you have a leadership issue, you usually get a motivational speaker. The same thing applies in this realm. You don't have to always do the showcases and the things that you want to demonstrate to your staff from your own environment. You can say, X organization has done this, Y organization has done that. We have a speaker from this who is a subject matter expert who will talk to you about where it's moving. And there's a lot of places in the world where this is even being supported by government. So, for example, in Denmark, you have this transparency initiative where all reported incidents are actually there for the public to review and view on a high level. So try to figure out how much of that can you subject your staff to, so that they don't think that this is being enforced on their organization because they've done something wrong. They see that it's part of a global trend that we need to keep up with to stay in the business.
Oh, definitely. That's an excellent point, because we know that donors and funders are asking for more and more oversight and accountability of the funds and resources that they're giving. So that's an excellent point. So, Mohammed, if you are going to advise small to medium-sized nonprofit organizations on how to best approach internal communications, for example, when it comes to reporting or making sure people are aware of what the investigation teams does or why it's important, do you have any suggestions on how they could do that in a realistic and approachable way?
Actually, I do. And I'm going to share a life example. So, last year, as a pro bono thing, while I was freelancing, I advised a small organization on how to tone their communication. So the idea is, they really find it hard to say you have to report or whatever it is in a very formal language. So what we've done is we've created a cartoon character and we called it Anna. Let's say, of course, I'm paraphrasing the name. So initially, we started by rolling out Anna, saying Anna comes early to work, having a lot of posters about Anna, or maybe small videos that you can do on your desktop or laptop. Anna comes early to work. Anna drinks her coffee while working. Anna takes productivity seriously, Anna, and all the small things. And then when people started liking Anna, because Anna is fun and it's a cartoon character, we started with introducing new methods. So Anna always reports when she sees something wrong. Anna is always suspicious when she doesn't understand things and she tries to understand. Anna knows that the reporting channel for X, Y, and Z is going to the focal point or doing this. So it was much easier to introduce these messages through a character like Anna than to actually just have really raw, dry legal language that says 1, 2, 3, or a process that says 1, 2, 3. And that actually worked for a small organization. So that's an example. I'm not saying you have to introduce Anna into your culture, but I'm saying there's always options and don't be afraid to think outside the box.
I love that. I love that. It's a cartoon character. She's the employee of the month, or she's the model employee. And starting out, I think, with that softer messaging, you know, Anna makes sure that she has her badge with her. Anna makes sure that if she sees a stranger in the building, she asks if she can help them.
She locks her laptop, something small.
And then moving on to, if Anna sees something suspicious, she reports it and she feels comfortable reporting. I think that's brilliant. I love it.
Yeah.
That's great.
And it works.
Yeah. When you are trying to design these structures and working in them, it obviously does take resources. It takes people's time. Sometimes it can maybe even take specialized tools, depending on the type of investigation. So how would you advise a small to medium-sized organization to identify or advocate for the resources that it takes to develop and establish an investigations program?
Okay, so there's a few ways to look at that point. So the first one is you have to know your size of operation. So if you're a small to medium of 100 staff type of organization, it's a bit different than if you're a 10 staff or 5 staff type of organization. So if you're more on the medium end of it, you can encourage some of your control functions, or at least the functions that have some control within their job description, to do continuing professional education by, for example, joining ACFE or getting into certifications that deals with investigation, like Certified Fraud Examiner or other simpler types of certifications. By doing that, these individuals will have the capacity to support you, not as their main role, but as a hat that they wear when needed in that domain. And that usually works really well, because you're not actually introducing an external element to the environment. You're actually just growing people that are already within the environment, and hopefully you choose the people that are already well respected and loved within the environment, so they're not taken in the wrong manner. And once they build their capacity, they will be able to also advise the management on the best structure for that type of environment. Because if you go to any of the main foundations that deals with these issues, they have a lot of ready tools, a lot of white papers. If you go on Google and just look for different structures, you get a lot of options and you can pick and choose what works for you. You don't have to follow any of these A to Z. You just can customize it to your needs. And I'm not saying it's going to be something that you're going to do in a few hours. It will take effort, but it usually pays off in the long term. However, if you're looking at the small end of the organizations, like the organizations of 5 to 10 people or similar to that, in that case, it's usually external support is recommended, meaning having people to come and, for example, once a year to do a fraud awareness or something about investigations or whistleblowing or the importance there to speak up. Or sometimes you can actually get online training providers that have generic trainings towards these aspects. These are all encouraged, but I think in the small around, you have, for example, if you go to ACFE, you have a list of professionals that you can even contact as freelancers to do the investigation for you. And if you usually go to an individual, it's not as expensive as going for a big firm. You're actually just paying the individual their time or the portion of their time that they need to do the investigation. So there are options for small to medium organizations, but it depends on where they are. And the more mature and the bigger their operation it is, the more they're able to invest. And it's a progressive, continual improvement process. So the moment you start with the small things and they show effects, it's easier to justify your next step or getting a more complex structure that pretty much addresses more and more of the control gaps that you may have.
That's excellent, Mohammed. I agree. I think that what you were saying about hopefully finding people who are already in a control role, and then you said hopefully they're loved as well. I was going to think in my head how many control role people are loved, but you know, I'm sure that they exist out there.
They exist. Or in our mind, they exist, because otherwise we're both hated. So
yeah. And then also, I'm glad that you're plugging ACFE, because I'm also a certified fraud examiner as well. And ACFE does have some amazing resources available. And I'll make sure in the show notes, I'll add some links there to the ACFE so that folks can check it out. The CFE exam is not necessarily the easiest one, but it's certainly something that if given enough time and study, people can manage through the CFE exam as well. So
and there, great there's points. They can always look at the relevant sections. Like, so for example, if you have something within a small organization, they can actually read the second section, which is relating to the investigation, without having to do the law section, because it's not relevant for that organization. So it's even the manual itself, you can pick and choose what is more relevant for you. No one is telling you, you have to get the full package at any point in time.
Definitely. And I also think your point about right sizing what it is you need. If you're a 5 to 10 person organization, that's one thing. If you're 50 to 100, maybe that's something different and you need a little bit more formalized structures in place. This all comes down to, though, leadership and management and board awareness and engagement around things like fraud and compliance and the need for investigations. So let me ask you this. How would you advise leadership, management, board members of small to medium-sized third sector organizations to engage with and best support the creation, establishment, ongoing working of an investigation program within their organization?
So that's actually really interesting. And that's something that from observation, sometimes a lot of the leadership get it wrong. It's important to start with yourself. So it's important that you as leadership are not the ones that always gets away with trying to find a way around a certain process or something, even with the good intentions. You should start with yourself. You should show your staff. Your first call is never to do a waiver of a control or something like that. So start with yourself by demonstrating how bought into controls you are. Start with yourself by actually encouraging, I'm not going to say investigations, but at least encouraging audits into managerial aspects of the business. Starts by saying, oh, we want an actual audit of the board decisions. We want an actual audit of this and that, or a review of this and that. And if it has a finding, say, you're okay with this being investigated. So starting by showing that you are okay with this being enforced in you is the first step. And once this step is actually on the way, that makes the rest a lot easier. That makes breaching the message and saying zero tolerance and saying that you are supporting the investigation, saying that you aren't presuming anything until the investigation results are out, saying all of these things, when you actually walk the walk, the talk becomes a lot more believable. So my message to boards and leaderships and management of small to medium organization, try to, even if you're pushing it a bit more than usual, to set the example, regardless of how that is, demonstrate that you yourself are not an exception to the rule, and then everything else would fall smoothly.
I think that's great. Leading by example and sort of the tone at the top is what we hear a lot about. We also hear about the mood in the middle and the buzz at the bottom too. So, but that's really good advice for leadership and management. Yeah. And I'm going to ask you a question very specifically for board members then, because you know, a lot of governance conversations these days with ESG coming up have been really, what is the role of boards and what are boards doing these days? Are they really engaging? Are they micromanaging? Are they completely disengaged? So if you are a board member of a small to medium sized organization, or even for this one, I'll open it up to the large ones too. If you're a board member of a third sector organization, what three questions as a board member should you be asking your organization's management and leadership as it relates to investigations, whistleblowing, and fraud? As a board member, what can you be asking to ensure that your organization is giving the appropriate amount of attention and resources to this area and to demonstrate that you feel that this is an area of priority for the organization?
Thank you for the question. I think a lot of people have heard me say that I always have questions that management, leadership, board members should always ask themselves. So first question relates to how you triage a certain incident or effect. Don't triage it based on your preference or what you perceive as the damage or the potential loss from that specific incident. Always ask yourself not how it will affect my organization. Actually, the right question is, how does this incident affect my beneficiaries? Because it might be something that if you say how it affects my organization, you might actually just end up with, this would delay my salary or payroll cycle, or this might delay my financial statements. But if you actually go with the more of how does this affect my beneficiary, and you end up with a child will end up sleeping hungry, or a mother will have to work two jobs because we've lost this amount, which might not be significant when you look at your organization. It makes a lot more sense about how you actually identify the impact of any incident, and it will trigger you to have the right response when it comes to whether to investigate or not, and whether to give this an attention or not. So that's the first question. How does this affect my beneficiary? The second question is always the golden rule for any investigation is, when you're looking at any part of the processes or cycles that are involved in the investigation, be it procurement or something else, always ask yourself when the process is being described to you, what can go wrong? So don't say the procedure says 1, 2, 3. Okay, the procedure, the policy, the framework always says 1, 2, 3, but they're not divine in nature. They always miss something. So you still have to ask yourself, especially if you're an external party or someone coming with a fresh view to that function, what can go wrong? And that would actually, even if it's not something that will directly affect the results of the investigation, it will affect your recommendations by giving better solid recommendations that can address control gaps. And the last question, of course, is how can I fix it? So the leadership should actually always ask themselves, if they find control of the gaps, or if they find that the investigation has substantiated that something went wrong, they need to understand that the next logical question is, how can we fix it? Who needs to own that fixing process? And when can it be done? And will it be effective if it's fixed? So these are my three questions. How does it affect my beneficiaries? What can go wrong, and how can we fix it?
I think that first question is great, Mohammed. I think so many times when we are approaching any aspects of risk and compliance, our own, where we sit, sort of determines where we stand, as they say, and sort of our own biases, privileges, whatever you want to call it, can color how we respond. And I love reframing the question, how will this impact the beneficiaries? That, I think, could be a very motivating question too, if you're trying to advocate for resources. Instead of saying, well, you know, we'll have to report to the Charities Commission, right? Obviously, reputational risk is massive for third sector organizations, but actually reframing it, say it's not about us, it's about our beneficiaries, it's about our participants. If this happens, how will it impact them? I think that's really powerful. How would you advise a small to medium-sized NGO if they are on the fence, or if they're not sure, if they need investigations, or if they're so overwhelmed that they just don't know where to begin? What would your advice be for them on how to get started in the area of investigations, and how to determine if it's should be a priority for them?
Okay, I'm going to be a bit melodramatic in this. My advice is, when it comes to issues of integrity or investigation, it's not about budget. It's not about management direction. It's about having a clear conscience. So if you feel that you have a clear conscience by not letting these things happen, and you can sleep safely without it, and knowing that a beneficiary might be taken an advantage of, then you probably don't belong in this sector. But if you think that you need to do these things for your conscience, always consult your conscience. That's where you actually get your drive and the power, and you'll definitely the required justifications to go into that domain. So just make sure that in your mind, it's not about donor requirement. It's not about what should be done because someone told you. It's about integrity. It's about doing what's right. It's about having a clear conscience at the end of the night. It's not about the politics.
I think that's brilliant. Let me ask you this question, Jen. When you are structuring these types of investigation programs, should there be a difference between how you approach internal investigations? So let's say, for example, it's staff-to-staff harassment, something like that, versus if it involves a participant or a beneficiary. Are there differences that you would advise, or is it pretty much the same, just be more aware? If a small to medium-sized organization is going to structure an investigation program, should they have a difference depending on who's involved, or would it be the same?
Okay, so in terms of the activities that are going to be done and the level of precision in the activities, it should be the same. However, when you're involving an external third party, you should keep in mind that external third party is not bound by the confidentiality agreement that you sign within the organization. So you might want to be more careful when asking questions, not giving a lot of things. Also, when you're involving with external parties, they might not be obliged to respond to you, while your staff might actually have this as part of your code of conduct. So you might want to actually assess, when dealing with external parties, what level of governance do you have over these relationships? And for some of them, you might actually want to consider whether you want to formalize these things. So for example, when dealing with partners or when dealing with vendors, you might actually have an agreement within your normal agreement, have clauses that give you access to do these types of investigations. So when you go externally, the additional step is you want to make sure that you're not giving something that's going to be eventually harmful to your organization. So you're actually balancing the message out, because they're not bound by confidentiality the same way your internal staff is bound. However, you should always go with your conscience. So don't say, because I don't want to harm the reputation of my organization, I don't care that an external party got harassed. That's not the right thing to do. So always do an additional risk assessment when you're dealing with an external party to the governance of things and what can go wrong of things, just as an added step in your planning. But the process itself of how you conduct things should be exactly the same.
And those are great points about the confidentiality and about the obligation to engage in the investigations. So how do you stay on top of the changing environment in the area of investigations? How do you stay on top of risks, the changing information, and the trends in this area?
There are a lot of journals out there, white papers out there. There are a lot of the journals coming from ACFE and other organizations like the IIA, all of these big organizations. Most of them are either for a minimum membership of $100 or so, or some of them are even free. The simplest thing is you can go into your alerts, whether it's Google Alerts or whatever it is, and add these keywords to your alerts. And whenever something goes in the news or something goes in articles that relate to these aspects, you keep on up to date by reading it and seeing what's the new trends. And I find this, regardless of the size of the organization, the most effective manner for me. Some people are more inclined to find classroom learning or online learning. There's a lot of videos out there that you can watch. There's a lot of webinars, seminars that are being published on LinkedIn. Just stay tuned to whatever actually is the best medium or channel for you, be it a podcast, be it a video, be it a seminar, or be it actually just reading articles. And I think you'll find your pace and you'll stay updated. It's not a hard job. The hardest thing about it is to start it.
Absolutely. Do you have any specific platforms or continuing education places or tools that you can recommend for people who are listening, maybe that are inexpensive or free? Is there anything that you can recommend in the areas of investigations?
Yeah, so there's a few things that I might be able to recommend. So initially, you can sign up for the newsletter for ACFE, so you can get that for free. There's a few trainings that UN-related organizations have online free for all their partners, vendors, or anyone who wants to do business with them. And these are not login specific, so you can go and do these trainings for free just from their own website. So for example, UNICEF has one, and a few of the other organizations in the UN has one. If you reach me to my LinkedIn and you tell me what your interest is, I'm more than happy to advise you in a few of the outlets that you can refer to.
Is there anything that we didn't cover? Is there anything that you want to add? Anything else that we didn't talk about that you think would be really helpful for small to medium-sized NGO staff to think about?
I think the only thing that I think we covered in this chat, but I think the first thing that I want to always say is never be afraid to reach out. So reach out, try to understand. Don't think that you have to take any rash decisions while you're not informed. So whenever you're in doubt, reach out. There's always people that are willing to give you advice. There's always the bodies of knowledge that you can consult with. Reach out. Don't think that you are the only organization that's facing that. There's plenty of people in the same shoes you are. So if you're not sure, reach out.
You're not alone. That's excellent advice. And so speaking of being not alone, if people want to reach out to you, Mohammed, how can they find you? What's the best way for them to reach out to you if they have questions or they want to talk to you more?
Okay, so I'm more than happy to share my personal email address, which is m.shaheen@gmail.com. They can send me an email or do Google chat or something like that. Also, I'm very active on LinkedIn. So if you go to Mohammed Shaheen, you'll actually be able to find me on LinkedIn. And I'm more than happy to pick up a conversation at any point in time.
That's awesome. I'll make sure I put all of that into the show notes so people can get in touch with you if they have more questions and they want to learn more from the awesome Mohammed Shaheen. So thank you so much for joining me with this conversation today. I had such a great time and you've raised so many excellent points. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you very much for having me. And it's always a pleasure talking to you, Sabrina. I'm looking forward to the rest of the podcast you're going to publish and the rest of this project. I'm looking forward to following it up and learning from it myself. I'm really happy to be part of it.
Oh, that's very kind of you. Thanks so much, Mohammed. So that's our show for today. Please remember to like, subscribe, and follow us for all your third sector risk information. Thanks for listening to Tolerable Risk.